This is our final week of this gospel growth class, and it's been a joy to get to talk with you guys about this topic. This is also my first time back in a couple weeks, and I'm excited to have the chance to round out the series. So our hope and our prayer throughout this whole thing is that it's been helpful for you guys, not just more knowledge to learn, but actually more things to help you have conversations with your neighbors, with your coworkers, with your friends, and bring Christ to bear on all areas of life. If you still need a handout, if you have not gotten a handout yet, would you just raise your hand? It would help Alexis and Elias as they're passing them out. When I was in seminary, one of my church history professors gave us this advice. He said, you should have a friend from every century. And so I started a note on my phone that day, just listing out the centuries from the first century to the 21st, and I began to be on the lookout for who my best friends would be. So I want to introduce you guys to someone this morning. He's my friend from the second century. My friend from the first century, if you're wondering, is Jesus. From the second century, it's this guy named Irenaeus. Now, Irenaeus, he was a bishop or a pastor in what is now known as France. And he was a firm defender of the Christian faith. One of his best-known works is, if you buy it today in its English translation, it's about 500 to 600 pages, defending the Christian gospel against heresies. And he called the book Against Heresies. But he also has a shorter work. It's this one. And it's called On the Apostolic Preaching. And this work begins with an address to his friend. And he's writing this, he's explaining to his friend, because he wants to encourage him to endure in the faith. He wants to encourage him to keep the faith that he started, and he grounds it in what he says is truth. And he says this, he says, the truth brings about faith. For faith is established upon things truly real, that we may believe what really is as it is, and believing what really is as it is, we may always keep our conviction of it firm. In other words, he's trying to ground his friend in the real world. And how does he do that? Well, if you keep reading the rest of the book, what he does is he tells a story. And the story that he tells is the story of the Bible. He begins with the creation of the world in Genesis, and he moves through the Old Testament, through the story of Israel, into the New Testament, culminating in the saving work of Christ. In fact, it looks pretty similar to what Stephen did in Acts 7. So in other words, in order to ground his friend in the real world, Irenaeus, in order to encourage him to keep his faith, he tells him the story of the Bible. And this story was to be the thing that his friend oriented his life around, the thing that he lives by. So today we're going to follow a similar structure to what we've been doing each week. We're going to be looking at a cultural value to cultivate in each of us some cultural literacy. And then we're going to move to a tool for engagement. But as we're doing this, I want you to mull over this question in the back of your mind. I want you to consider for yourself what story you live by. That is, what's the controlling narrative in your life that animates your decisions, that inspires you to press on, that gives you hope in times of crisis, the story that forms your vision of the good life? What story do you live by? Well, if you can follow along in your notes, the cultural value that we're looking at today is relativism. And relativism perhaps doesn't quite need an introduction because it's the underlying philosophy that kind of undergirds all the other values that we've looked at in previous weeks. Things like inclusivity, individualism, hedonism, all these things kind of presuppose the preeminence or the authority of the individual. And it's so pervasive in our culture, and yet its pervasiveness is kind of confusing to us as Christians because in some ways, its incoherence is so readily apparent. And yet, remember, our goal for today is one of empathy. We want to empathize with this view so that we can see how to understand it, because that'll help us engage well. So I threw up this definition here for relativism, and it's in your notes because it's a long one. But this is from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, and they say this: relativism is the view that truth and falsity, right and wrong, so think of reality, what's true, and then moral, what's right and wrong, standards of reasoning, and procedures of justification are products of differing conventions and frameworks of assessment, and that their authority is confined to the context giving rise to them. So that's a pretty wordy definition. So in simpler terms, relativism is the notion that a belief or an idea can be true for one person or culture, and its opposite be true for another. In other words, one's belief, one's moral framework, one's view of the world is relative to circumstances, upbringing, culture, context, all these things. And I think with that, it's helpful to revisit this paradigm one last time. We talked about this all the way in week one, and Chan brought it up a couple weeks ago too. But we talked about this shift from modernism to postmodernism. And this shift to postmodernity as we have it today is at the same time just the rational endpoint of a naturalistic modernist worldview. But then it's also a reaction against the pride of modernity. Whereas modernists were convinced that they could discover truth through faculties of human reason, the modernists realized that humans are far too shaped by their context to actually be a blank slate that can somehow discover truth on their own. And so relativism, as we know it, has kind of arisen because we're so conditioned by the world around us. There's no way that any of us, the postmodernists would say, can transcend our cultural moment to realize and know objective truth that applies for everyone. And in a sense, they're kind of on the right track, except for one thing, and that's that the transcendent God has entered time and space to make himself known through his word and through Christ Jesus. But nonetheless, here are just some phrases that encapsulate a relativistic framework, maybe some slogans of the time. Can I just get a volunteer to read this list for me, nice and loud? Okay, you did a good job of emphasizing some key words there, and it kind of leads into this question. What is ironic about these statements? What's that? Yeah, in a sense, these are absolutizing principles. In other words, these are statements that are imposing a standard by which everyone else should live. It's this totalizing worldview. You should be tolerant. You should never do this. You should always do this. And so it may be obvious to us as believers that relativism does not withhold a moral framework. It cannot stand that test. But I do want to go a step deeper. And I want to look at what really might be at the heart of relativism. I want to suggest that at its core, relativism is not a question about is there objective truth or not, but it's a question of authority. Why might that be the case? Well, this is not just from a Christian perspective. This is atheist philosopher John Searle, not the quote on the screen, but this atheist philosopher, he himself has argued that what drives relativism is the desire to be in control, the desire to be one's own authority. So I was helped by the quote that you see on the screen here by Paul Copen. He's an apologist, and he says this: the relativist doesn't accept any external authority or any authority statements about truth, morality, or God, but the relativist acts as his or her own authority. So we've kind of entered and we've explored this, and I've tried to get at what is the heart of moral relativism. And now, as we move to challenge this value and extend the gospel, we should remember this heart-level position. But if we want to see, when we're exposing, what do we affirm, if you remember, what do we affirm about a worldview, and what do we challenge, I want to suggest this. We want to affirm that relativism actually rightly understands that humans are finite creatures. That is, we're limited. We are limited creatures, But the solution or their suggestion of how to apply this is incoherent and incorrect. So this is actually something that we're able to affirm about a relativistic impulse. Humans are far too limited and far too dependent to claim absolute moral authority over another. And humans on our own should not presume to know what's true in all places and all times on our own. So the relativist rightly understands that humans are not a moral authority in and of themselves for others. However, they look at their finitude and we kind of see these two responses. The relativist responds to their finitude by seeking to act in place of God. The relativist looks at their limited capacity and they say that if no one else can be my own authority, then I'm going to be my authority. And the promise of control and self-governance sounds enticing, is it not? You are the one who knows good and evil. Does that sound like any familiar biblical narrative to you? Isn't that the very same lie that the serpent tempted Adam and Eve with in the garden? The serpent said to the woman, "You will not surely die, for God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God." And how will he be like God? Knowing good and evil. It sure is enticing to be a God unto yourself, isn't it? Up to this point in Genesis 3, if we were kind of reading along and walking through Genesis 1, Genesis 2, Genesis 3, we'd see that the whole time God looks at his creation and what? He sees that it is good. And then for the first time, Eve looks at the fruit and she sees that the fruit is good. And at that point, a whole lot of things started to unravel as soon as humans became the moral authority for themselves. So relativists see this limited nature of humanity as a basis for becoming their own God, in a sense, their own authority. But as Christians, we locate our finitude, we locate the fact that we are limited creatures in the fact that we are created by someone. And therefore, we are dependent not on our culture and not on ourselves to know what's good, but on our Creator. And so we believe that the creator of this world has made himself known to us, and that changes the way that we think about moral judgments. And so it's not that we claim to be any source of authority for us or others, but we trust in the authority of the one who has spoken to us. So the question to ask is, who is the most reliable source of authority? Is it me? Is it you? Or is it God? And yet for the relativist, a major barrier to accepting Christ is this question of authority. To become a Christian, for them, might seem to be like they are giving up their own authority, because in a sense, and in reality, they are, and they're coming into submission to another. And authority and submission can get a bad rep today, and in many ways, it's because we've seen over and over again, authority is abused and misused by those who have it. So a way that we extend the gospel to a relativist, the way that we show them the truth of the gospel, is in a way to show them that it's a good thing to be under a good authority. And that necessitates that we show how the gospel is beautiful. And so we're going to move into our final tool, and that's this, storytelling. As Christians in a world like ours, we should be burdened to show that the gospel is not only true, although it certainly is, but it is beautiful. And a way to do that is through stories. So we've kind of walked through some tools for engagement, right? We've looked at hospitality. We've looked at treating the heart and not the symptoms. And then we've looked at being a question asker. But all of these kind of culminate in the fact that as Christians, we are tasked with speaking the gospel to others. And so this question of why stories, why are stories an effective technique for engaging others? Well, a book that we've been referencing a bunch in this class is this book, and I would highly recommend it to you guys. It's called Telling a Better Story by Joshua Chatraw. And here are the reasons that he offers for the importance of stories. One, stories are unavoidable for us as humans. I mean, one of the first things that I do when I get home after a day of work and I see my wife is to talk about my day and to listen to her day. And then we're exchanging stories about what's happened. And then every Thursday when we get home from work, we turn on the TV to watch the latest episode of Survivor. And every commercial break, there's a story that's being told about how this product or service is going to make your life better. When we're listening to a sermon, even, anytime a sermon starts to tell a story, you can kind of see people in the room start to perk up. They lift their heads. Stories are unavoidable for us as humans. And also, stories help us make sense of the world around us. In fact, to go back to hearing stories in sermons, I think some of the most pressing points that I can remember are when the pastor or preacher has used a story to illustrate a truth that the Bible is presenting to us. We live by stories. They help us make sense of the world around us. In fact, we see this even in pop culture today. One of the prevailing metaphors, I'm not as hip with the times as I used to be, but I still know that there's this language of considering yourself the main character, being the main character. And that has kind of shaped a whole generation's way of thinking about their highs and lows in life. It's a story that they live by to make sense of what's good and what's bad is by viewing it as, well, character development. It's the triumphs and defeats of being the main character. This is why stories are such an effective tool for explaining things. Then also, and this is important for today, even in post-Christian cultures, Joshua Chatterall makes this point. He says, we can't seem to escape the echoes and allures of the gospel story. The allure of the gospel story is something that many can't shake, even if they're not Christians. This man named Julian Barnes, he's an agnostic author from the UK, and he said this at one point in his life. He said, I don't believe in God, but I miss him. And he goes on to say this. He says, we are a narrative animal, aren't we? We live by stories. Sometimes true, sometimes false. We want the news to be turned into stories. We want a narrative even when there's no narrative. We want our human life on this planet to be turned into a narrative. I'm much more skeptical of that. I think there are lots of instances where there is no narrative, or the narrative is one we wouldn't want to accept because it's too painful to bear. So when Barnes says that he doesn't believe in God, but he misses him, he's not referring to a time in his life where he used to be a Christian, because in fact, he's grown up irreligious his whole life. What he means is that there's something compelling about the story that the Bible tells us. And to not embrace this world of the Bible as true reality, is in a sense to miss out on something. It's to miss out on something beautiful. And so a tool for engagement that we want to develop and cultivate is to learn how to speak the gospel as a story, and more than that, as a beautiful story. Because when we do that, it helps us and it helps others to make sense of the world around them. So the question that should cause us to reflect on is, do we see the story of the Bible as beautiful? Or are we in a season now where we're stuck in a rut where the Bible is too familiar to us, or we're stuck in a rut where we reduce the gospel down to a series of facts that we mentally assent to and then go on with our lives? So I want to talk today, use our last couple minutes here in this class, to talk about how we can recapture our imagination with the Bible. I think it was talked about in a previous week, but Christian engagement is not just about what we do, but about who we are. And so before we look out to how we engage others, it's important to consider, how is our own heart shaped by this gospel message that we are taking to others? And so I just have a couple practical things for us to consider. The first one is this: look for themes in popular stories that reflect the biblical story. And you don't really have to look far to see this. It's just a way for us to view our world through the lens of the Bible to see how are these stories that have captured imagination over the years, how do they point to themes and echoes and allures that the gospel story has? Another idea is to read books from people who expand your view of the gospel. I think of authors like C.S. Lewis, who is just renowned for using stories as a way to communicate something about the Bible to the world. In the PDF, or I attached a PDF to the QR code that'll be up at the end of this lesson with an article by a lady named Dorothy Sayers. And she wrote this brief work called The Greatest Drama Ever Told. And I think that is an example of someone who talks about the Bible in a way that's beautiful. And as I've read it, it helps me to see that. And so I think reading books from people who see the Bible and the gospel as beautiful helps us to grow in our understanding of that. But then lastly, and what I want to spend the most time on, is this. Enter and explore the textual world of the Bible. And here's what I mean by this. I think we often kind of conceptualize our Bible reading. We think about reading our Bible in the morning as hunting for buried treasure. And we go on this expedition and we kind of have to work through all the sediment and all the rocks to somehow find something of value for us for that day. When we view the Bible in this way, I think it threatens to reduce it down to maybe a self-help book or maybe just a list of things in need of us to come in and get all the dirt away to make it more relevant to my life for that day. And that often causes us to gravitate away from narratives within the Bible or to kind of reduce these stories down to repackaged moral lessons for us to follow that day. But what if we shifted the way that we read our Bibles? What if we shifted the way that we viewed what it means to read our Bibles? What if instead of hunting for buried treasure, reading the Bible is rather a lot like exploring another world? We enter it, we explore this world on this journey, and then we find that when we come back from our journey, we feel a little different than when we left. Something has changed us. My visit to this new world that the Bible is presenting to me changed me. And then I can't stop thinking about the next time that I can go back to the world that the scriptures present to me. A world with great miracles and mighty acts of God. A world in which God is intimately involved in the affairs of his people. A world in which this God who created everything binds himself to his creation through covenants, making promises that he is going to fulfill in spite of consistent rebellion against him. A world in which this God remembers his promises to his people and ultimately fulfills them all by sending himself, by sending his own son to take on flesh and enter the broken world in order to redeem it, because he came to seek and to save the lost. But then as we explore this world, we start to realize that this isn't just a world that we're escaping to. It's the real world. The actions of God in the world of the Bible impact me in my world today. When Christ came to seek and to save the lost, that included me. When Christ's death on the cross atoned for sins, it included my own. And when Christ rose from the dead, it assured that I too will live though I die. The world that the Bible presents to us spans from creation to new creation. And as such, all of history is encapsulated in its pages. So the Bible is not just one version of reality among many. It claims to be the only real world. And as such, as we enter that, we have to respond to its claims. So there's this author named Eric Auerbach, and he puts it this way. He says, the Bible's claim to truth is tyrannical. And I want you to think about this, especially in light of our discussion on relativism as well, that claims there are many worlds, many authorities, many truths. The Bible's claim to truth is tyrannical. And that means that it excludes all other claims. The world of the scripture stories is not satisfied with claiming to be a historically true reality. It insists that it is the only real world. It is destined for autocracy. Far from seeking merely to make us forget our own reality for a few hours, the Bible seeks to overcome our reality. And listen to this. We are to fit our own life into its world, feel ourselves to be elements of its structure and universal history. When this happens, the real world of the Bible has very tangible effects in your life and my life every day. As our world is shaped by the world of the Bible, as the story of the Bible captures our imaginations, as we begin to relive by this story, it resensitizes us to who God is and how he is at work in this world, and it causes us to see him in all his beauty. And as we see the gospel story in all of its beauty, it leads us to speak of its beauty to others as well. So that's the final encouragement. In our class, we've looked at this framework for engagement. We've attempted to implement that framework into all these different cultural values, and we sought to equip us with various tools for engagement. So it's been a joy to work through these things with you, but I hope that the thing that we leave with is this. Christian engagement should always end with speaking the truth of the gospel to our neighbors. Live by the story of the Bible and draw others in to do the same. I'll close in prayer and then you guys are dismissed. Father, as we look around the world and as we see that stories are unavoidable for us, I think we can far too often look to all the different narratives that we are being told to order our lives around. Stories of progress, of achievement, the American dream, wealth, fame, acclaim, whatever it is, these are stories that we order our lives around. But I pray that as we go forth as readers of your word, that the story that we live by, like Irenaeus in the second century, like believers who have gone before us, our lives would be oriented around the story of the Bible. And that as we do that, we would see you in all your beauty, and that we would be motivated and encouraged to take that very same beauty to a needy world. But we also recognize that we can only do this because of the work that Christ continues to do in the world today through the Spirit. And so we just trust in you for these things. We ask all these things in your name. Amen.